It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios. Welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
Had to listen to more of that because that's Stars and Stripes Forever. If ever there were American songs, those are they. That's John Philip Sousa. He was an American composer who wrote so many marches and really was a uniquely American sound. If anyone ever asks you what it means to be an American, what it sounds like and feels like, it really is exemplified in the music of John Philip Sousa. This is Sandy Rios in the morning again, and we are here to celebrate all of you war heroes, any of you who put on the uniform and marched into battle on behalf of this country. We give you the most, the deepest thanks. You know, I think back to a quote by John Quincy Adams, who said once, "You will never know how much it cost my generation to preserve your freedom. I hope you make good use of it." Well, I guess the jury's out, isn't it, as to whether we've made good use of it. There is a special on television right now about the spies, Washington spies, called Turn. Pretty violent, pretty interesting, but it traces, you know, some of the sacrifices of those early years, and it really is a very good thing to be reminded what they went through. It's just an amazing thing, what they did in order to make it possible for us to be free. And then moving on into the other generations, after that we had all of the casualties of the Civil War, people going to battle to save the country, to make sure it stayed unified and also to make sure that men were free. It really is a remarkable story as hundreds of thousands of men in the North and the South gave their lives in this terrible conflict. And then we go to the Spanish-American War, less known, but still a war, World War I, horrible casualties, terrible stories of men who fought. World War II, the great threat of Nazism and the spread of totalitarianism around the globe. And many of our fathers marched into that battle. And then Vietnam. Many of your fathers were in Vietnam, your husbands, your uncles, and you remember the sacrifices that they made. And, of course, there was also Korea, which was a battle that some of us still had family members who fought in that great battle, kind of the unsung. That, by the way, the memorial here in D.C., one of the ones that I love the most is the Korean War Memorial. If you haven't been to that, it is absolutely beautiful. But Desert Storm, and then, of course, Iraq. Some of you are listening now, and you've lost sons. Many of you have lost limbs and have been injured. But you know that there have been tremendous sacrifices made by our men and women to save us and to make us free. Admiral James Lyons, he was an officer of the U.S. Navy for 36 years. But he served as the Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Pacific Fleet, which, of course, is the largest single military command in the world. He also served as a senior U.S. military representative to the United Nations. And as the Deputy Chief of Naval Operations from 1983 to 1985, he was the principal advisor on all Joint Chiefs of Staff matters and was the father of the Navy Red Seal, an anti-terrorism group comprised of Navy SEALs. Admiral James Lyons was also commander of the U.S. Second Fleet and commander of the NATO Striking Fleet, which were the principal fleets for the implementing of the Navy's maritime strategy. Admiral James Ace Lyons, born in 1927, he still speaks, lectures. He heads a group called the Lyon Associates. He's the CEO of that. And I am really honored that he should join us this morning. Good morning, Admiral Lyons.
Well, good morning to you and your listeners.
You know, I have to ask you, why did they call you Ace?
I got that playing from my football days at Navy.
All right. Well, that's a small thing to you today, but it's actually a very big thing. Where were you on December 7th, 1941?
I was in my parents' car. We were riding, as people did in those days, to a Sunday dinner in Red Bank, New Jersey, at the Molly Pitcher Hotel. I remembered it as clear as if it was yesterday.
Now, of course, you were a young teenager. Did you hear it on the radio? Or
on the car radio.
Oh. All right. So if you, looking back in time, this is an obvious question. Still, if you were to term what a change it made in your own personal life, were you planning on going into the Navy? Were your family Navy careerists? Did that have any impact on you at all?
Well, I was going to, I was always going to be a marine engineer. My family was in the steamship business. So I was always oriented towards the sea. So, you know, my migration into the Navy was not that difficult.
I'm curious about one thing. I wondered, as I was reading this morning and pondering, I need to say, Admiral Lyons, my own father was, he was 21 when this happened, and he had, and this is the reason why he ended up going into the military. I think in December, just past Pearl Harbor Day, he joined and had spent, but he joined the Army and you know, spent his time in France and England. But this changed so many different lives, and of course it has affected my life because of the trajectory of my own father serving in the war. But I'm curious to know, you know, the war was raging, we should say, in Europe. Why did we have such a strong fleet in the Pacific? Were we anticipating something with Japan?
Well, the main purpose, the decision was made to position the basic Pacific fleet in Hawaii as a deterrent force. The thinking was at that time, with such a strong display of our capability there, the Japanese would look elsewhere to attack. And what What your listeners need to know is, you know, we did have advance notice that an attack was going to occur. It certainly had all the symptoms. And it really goes back, it's starting in August of 1941. The Japanese became fascinated by the British attack on the Italian naval base at Taranto, which had a similar shallow water depth, similar to Pearl Harbor. And the British were able to go in and conduct a very successful attack using torpedoes and in shallow water. Well, this fascinated the Japanese, and actually the British were very successful. They essentially destroyed the Italian Mediterranean fleet. So there was a double agent by the name of Popov, and the Japanese sent a series of questions to the Germans. Popov was actually a British agent and the working with some of the high-level Germans. The Germans gave Popov questions. Popov was then sent by the Brits to America. He met with the FBI in August of 41. He gave them the questions. The questions then were paraphrased in such a way, were then turned over to military intelligence. And for some reason, it did not raise the level of awareness that it should have. Because the conventional thinking at the time was there was no way a torpedo attack could be conducted at Pearl Harbor since there was no such capability. That was the conventional thinking at the time. Secondly, we had also broken, following that event, the Japanese diplomatic code, PURPLE. And it was referred to as MAGIP. So we were reading, there were 10 people in Washington who were cleared to receive this sensitive intelligence information. And that was the president, the secretary of state, Cordell Hull, the secretary of war, Stimson, General Marshall, Admiral Stark, who was the chief of naval operations, Richmond Kelly Turner, the head of Navy war plans, and the head of Army war plans, and the heads of the two Army and Navy military intelligence organizations. Those were the only people authorized to receive this information. The purple machines were reproduced. Two were sent to Churchill in England for his use. The Army had two, the Navy had two, and one was sent to MacArthur in the Far East for his use. However, none were sent to Admiral Kimmel or Lieutenant General Short in Hawaii. Amazing.
Let's go back just a second, because you mentioned this British double agent, Dusko Popov, and you said he was the prototype for James Fleming's James Bond. I think that's really fascinating, first of all. And he was the one who carried the questions that the Japanese sent, asking questions about how Great Britain conducted their surprise attack on Toronto. I guess they wanted to know how they did it. The questions were that. What did you do? How did you do it? Is that what the questions were?
Exactly. And, you know, how did they modify the torpedoes for the shallow water?
Okay.
And they wanted all of this applied to, they wanted the same type of information on Pearl Harbor. And they were very explicit.
All right, so
They had other questions that related to other areas.
Okay.
You know, as far as how many planes were on the airfield, and mixed up in all of this is how many, what was our production capability,
right,
and what torpedo nets
Admiral
being
Lyons,
used.
We have to take we have to take a commercial break. My guest is Admiral James Lyons, the former commander in chief of the U.S. Pacific Fleet, and we'll be right back. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk. All right, Sandy Rios back with you. It is Memorial Day. It's the day when we remember all of those people that have served us so faithfully in the various armed forces. And, you know, back in D-Day of 2016, that was June the 6th, 2016, we actually went to the phones and talked to some of our precious veterans. And this is what we heard. Let's go to Randy in Indiana. Good morning, Randy.
Good morning. How are you, Sandy?
Good. What's on your mind this morning?
Well, my dad was a World War II veteran, and he was stationed in Cherbourg, France, and a master sergeant in a German POW camp. And he brought my foster brother home from France. And he wasn't involved with the D-Day thing, but he was one of the Allied troops that freed Cherbourg.
Yeah, wonderful. That's a great story, Randy. Good morning, Joseph.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. How are you?
How you doing?
I'm good. How old are you, Joseph?
I'm 91.
Wow. All right. So, what you served in World War II? Correct.
You're cutting out on me. What did I do? What, ma'am?
Did you serve in World War II?
Yes, I served with General George S. Patton in the Third Army. I landed the 6th of June '44 on an armed beachhead. Utah beachhead.
Wow. So, Joseph, you're one of the survivors.
Yeah, there's not many of us left.
Tell us, you were 16 then?
Yes.
So tell us about that day.
Well, as a young boy, I saw a lot of carnage. I'd never seen that many ships in my life. I'd never seen so much carnage in my life. But I volunteered to get in, and you know what? My mom and daddy signed for me. I got in a mess. I said, Lord, I'm in a mess over here. But I got through it. I got through it. Thank goodness the man above the clouds found favor with me.
So, Joseph, seriously, can you describe being on that boat, coming up to that beach? What did you see? What did you experience?
Well, we was watching the first wave went in. They got knocked out, and the second wave got knocked out. The third wave, just a handful of the third wave got in. They called for the fourth wave, and then some of the fourth wave got in, but not all of them. And then they called for the fifth wave. I was in the fifth wave. And so we got in.
And so you mean, and you when you got off those boats, you were right in the water. You had to walk in the water, did you not, in order to get to the beach?
Well, I was holding my M1 rifle over my head, and I was in water up to my chest.
Wow. And as you were walking, my understanding is that there were bodies all in the water, bodies on the beach. This is
all the bodies all over the water was from red.
And so, Joseph, in a moment like that, does a man pray or you just keep moving? What goes on in your mind?
Well, you know what went on through my mind? I couldn't believe that Hitler had done what he'd done. I had the blessing to go with General Patton to rescue that Dachau, that terrible prison camp.
Yes.
Sweetheart, there's carnage up there. You can't believe what happened there. My goodness alive. I couldn't believe that a man supposed to be a son of God could do a terrible thing there like Hitler did.
You know, Joseph, my father was in the Third Army under Patton also. And he was part of the group that came to Dachau. Isn't that interesting? My own father was in the same division with you. So when you got to Dachau, what did you have any idea at all about what you would see?
Well, when we got to Dachau, see, we went behind the enemy lines at night. And when we got to Dachau that morning, the CIA guy rolled out a map on the Jeep. And he said, here's Dachau and here's the guards. He said, I don't know what we're going to do if they want to surrender. Well, when they seen us, they jumped out of those towers and went through the woods like a deer. I could see that some of them were wearing number 10 soles, some 11 shoes. They went through the woods and never turned back. They're still running, I guess. We never did see them.
And so what happened next?
That was the guards.
And what happened next?
Well, I was at the time being, I was driving for Colonel Smith. He was an aide to General Patton. and he wanted me to take some TNT and put down by the side of that incinerator and blow it up. And he said, I want you to put three or four sticks in there. Well, when I got to the ordnance depot, they gave me a whole case. They said they didn't break the case, so I just took the whole case and put down there. And I told the boy, don't put your tripwire on there till I get away from here. I dug down and put as much down there as I could, and when I said fire in a hole, he pushed that tripwire, and that thing, when it blowed up, it went from here to the moon. It looked silver, and I never did see it fall. I don't know where it went.
This was,
went to the moon.
Joseph, this was the incinerator where they burned the Jews?
Sweetheart, can you turn your volume up just a little?
Is this the incinerator where they burned the bodies?
Oh, lady, you ain't never seen such a mess in your life since you've been living. We got there, there was two rail cars outside, flat cars. They had bodies stacked on each side like cordwood, 8 foot tall on each side of those two rail cars. It was fixed and taken to the landfill, but we got there before they did it.
Joseph, when you came into Dachau, did you, let me see if I can ask this clearly, your fright, your experience invading Normandy, landing on the beach, putting your life at risk, did you feel when you came into Dachau that it was worth what you had done?
Oh, yes, yes. I'd do it again 100,000 times again. Yeah.
Anything else you want to tell us about your experience?
Well, I had the pleasure of serving with General George S. Patton. He is the greatest general ever walked this earth. You know that, don't you?
I know he was a great general.
When all the wind up of this thing is over with, history will report and will reveal that George Patton saved the world. I was with that man from Normandy all the way to Berlin.
Wow. Joseph, do your children know your story? If you just tuned in, we're listening.
I tried to turn my volume up, but I can't find it.
Oh, can you hear me? If I talk like this, can you hear me?
Well, sweetheart, we just wrote a book. 14 of us World War II veterans got together and wrote a book. And it's on Amazon.
What's the name of it?
Hold just a minute. No, you're just going to ask me that just a minute. Get me a World War II book by selling that in that bag, would you?
If you just tuned in, this is Joseph, and he was...
I'll give you everything you need. Just hold it.
All right. I'm just telling people who you are. Joseph was 16 years old when he landed on Omaha Beach. He served with General George Patton in the Third Army. And this is a one in a million phone call. One in a million. Joseph, you are a jewel. I'm so glad you called. I'm so honored.
Well, sweetheart, I'd do it again. This is the greatest country in the world, but our country's in a mess right now.
Yep.
Our country's in a mess.
Yes, sir. Yes, it is. And that I think it's like your children. My dad was your age. It is our responsibility not to let the truth die. Our kids don't know what happened in public schools. Our grandchildren, it's our responsibility to teach them. Do you have the name of your book yet?
Yeah, Mama's going to have to hold just a minute.
Okay.
Mama's in that bag right there. In the bag by the desk.
It's on Amazon.
You find it. It's in
the bag. I found it, Daddy.
Okay. Oh, just a minute. I'm
okay.
Give you this right here.
All right, good.
Okay, now, 14 of us World War II veterans got together, and we wrote this book. It says, The Last Eyewitness of World War II Memories, from D-Day to 70th Anniversary. It was wrote by John Long and Walter Parks.
Wonderful. All right, Joseph, we're going to put that on our Facebook page, and you can bet that I'm going to be getting that book. Joseph, let me ask you, as you look back on this in terms of your relationship with God, did you feel that God did spare you on that day? And how is your relationship with him now?
Well, sweetheart, I belong to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and My father was an elder, and he gave me a priesthood blessing. If I would listen to my commanders and do what I was supposed to, I'd have the blessing to return. When I got on that beachhead and saw all that carnage, I said, Heavenly Father, that blessing needs to work. And it did. It did.
And you're in Mississippi now. You're spending your... And you and your wife are both still alive together, right?
Yes. We're both 91, and we're fixing to celebrate our 70th wedding anniversary, the 9th of August.
How about kids? You have kids?
Oh, yeah. I've got 3 children. Got a boy and 2 girls. But my boy passed away, but my 2 girls are still living. I took my 2 daughters up on the honor flight to Washington just a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, those are wonderful. Are they not wonderful, those honor flights? If people haven't heard about them, if you still have a World War II vet in your family, in your life, you need to Google honor flights and take them on these flights while you still can, because they are tremendous. Well, Joseph...
Well, all the veterans need to go up there and see the World War II monument. It sure is beautiful.
It really is. It's just, it is a beautiful tribute to the men and women who served in World War II. Let me go to Margaret in Texas. Good morning, Margaret.
Good morning.
Hey, so you actually do remember that day, June 6th, 1944.
Oh, yes.
Tell us, what was happening in your life?
We all clustered in the border. We just flooded that town of about 20,000 at that time.
Okay. And how old were you?
14.
All right. So what do you remember about that day?
I remember we were just all shouting and yelling. My dad was in the service, and there were 6 of us children, and he had been called to the Navy, and he wasn't home. And we were just overjoyed.
What did it mean to you?
We were jumping on cars. We were driving cars. I wasn't. I didn't drive. We were going up down that little main street that's about 3 miles long, and getting on our car, sitting on our cars while everybody else was driving them down, throwing, you know, things that didn't harm anything up in the air.
Margaret, did
and
you
just
think?
Having,
did you think that this was going to be the end of the war? Is that why you were so excited?
Oh yes, we knew it was. We knew it was, and our dad would come home. I'm 86 right now. My husband and I have been married for 70 years, and he's 88, and we remember it.
Yes, I'm sure that you do.
I was in high school.
Margaret, is there anything? Is there anything that, you know, as you look at this at the age at 86, 86 or 88? Did you say?
I'm 86. My husband Bill is 88.
When you look back on this, if you were to say even just one thing to the generations that are left, to your, you know, to the people that are listening right now, in regard to what that day meant to you and what you would want to hand off, what you'd want to teach as a result of that, what would it be?
I would say America needs to get back to God, open up your hearts, but maintain our borders and keep America great.
All right, Margaret. Thank you so much. I do appreciate you calling, and thank you for your service to this country, your patriotism, your love of it. And we wish you and your husband that you finish well. That's certainly my prayer at this point in my life. I'll pray that for you,
and
too.
And I've been an educator and a high school English teacher and a journalist for many years.
Wow. Well, I'm honored that you're listening, and it's great to hear from you, and you write me anytime. Let's go to Joan in Texas, because as I understand it, Joan was a hospice nurse, and she interviewed a veteran who was either involved or knew something. Good morning, Joan.
Hi, good morning, Sandy. Thank you for taking my call. This is a very emotional story for me, because I was very honored to have met this. And he actually was a young man. It was about 10 years ago. And his wife wanted to talk to me first. Anyway, she told me he had been a fighter pilot during World War II. And when I went in to talk to him, he was so young. And I said, I'm sorry, I said, we'll get to business soon, but do you mind if I ask you some personal questions first? And he said, no, that would be fine. Such a gentleman. And this daughter was about my age, and she was standing in the room, too. He only had the one child. And I said, your wife tells me that you were a fighter pilot during World War II. Thank you so much for your service. And I said, would you mind if I ask you how old you were? He was 16 when he was a fighter pilot in World War II. I said, how much training did you have? He said, oh, we got about 6 months training. Can you imagine? And his little daughter was standing there, and she looked at him with tears in her eyes, and she said, Daddy, I never knew. I never knew that.
Yeah, that's amazing. I know a lot of those guys. My father-in-law actually went over. He was, I think, 17, just turned 17. And some of them got, you know, falsified documents to get over there. My dad was young, too. He was 19, but 17, 16. And to be a fighter pilot, you're right. That's pretty amazing. Okay, Joan, that's a great memory. Thank you very much. Let's go to Roy in Oklahoma. Good morning, Roy. You remember this?
I think six or seven, but it was the end of the, it was VJ Day, and I was in Chicago.
Yeah.
People were celebrating.
Yes.
And as everybody was celebrating the end of the war, and I was 7 years old with my parents in downtown Chicago, and there was so many people that I couldn't breathe. They were crushing me up against my parents, and my dad finally realized and picked me up and put me up on his shoulders, which probably saved my life, or at least it felt like it. And one of the other things was my dad never went into the service. He was working for one of the defense plants, so he got an exemption from that.
Yeah.
And he was working for a plastics company making the Bakelite sockets for the radio tubes. And he'd bring home cases of that stuff over the weekend, and my whole family, myself even at that age, and my grandparents were breaking the flash off of the fake light when it came out of the mold so they'd be usable, and then filing and sanding them smooth. And it was amazing that people just volunteered their time to do this sort of thing. And they also had, I remember all the rationing where you couldn't get tires and gasoline and a lot of foods and things without getting stamps from the government to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And
you know,
the
Roy,
last kind of strange thing that was sort of related is I have an Aeroflight trailer, travel trailer. It's sort of like an Airstream, but more deluxe. It was made in a factory in Long Beach, California. At the end of the war, during the war, they had a contract to build mobile housing on the air base and to train the pilots before they take off for the war. When the war was over, they didn't have any more contracts, so they built these travel trailers, and there's only about 10 of them in the world left, and I just happened to run across one of them, not knowing what it was when I bought it, but it was kind of interesting that it was actually what they did with all the equipment and even materials that were left over from what they were doing for the war effort.
You know what's interesting, Roy, as you're talking, my husband and I were just talking about this, the difference between, of course, the experience of the veterans of World War II, who had the entire country behind them, with very few exceptions, everyone making sacrifices, everybody listening to the news every day, everyone with a vested interest, everyone that prayed, it was a person of prayer, praying and hoping and supporting and sacrificing. It was a unifying effort on the part of the American people. And when we got to Vietnam, we experienced for the first time as a country where the media, unbeknownst to us, was peeling off, subverting the efforts of our men. And of course, it was a different kind of war. I understand that. Nevertheless, I think that there's not a person who understands war that knows we could not have. We had a lot of victories in Vietnam. We probably could have prevailed in Vietnam had the country stayed unified. But it was the first time we saw the undermining of our soldiers and the war effort, so much so that there was no support whatsoever, and the soldiers was just left really to fend for themselves. It's really a disgraceful story. And I think that's why World War II soldiers couldn't understand Vietnamese American soldiers who fought in Vietnam, because their experiences were so vastly different. Roy, thank you. I really do appreciate you calling.
Well, that was recorded on June the 6th of 2016. And you can hear what a delight and an honor and a privilege it was for me to interact with various veterans and family members of people who remembered their war
experiences very well. I hope you'll stay tuned, because in the next segment, we're going to have a famous reading of a famous poem called Just a Common Soldier. Sandy Rios back with you in just a minute. All right, that's Stars and Stripes. That's one of my favorite John Philip Sousa songs. This is Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk. John Philip Sousa, by the way, was the first Marine Corps band director. And by the way, the Marine Corps band still is fabulous. If you have a chance to hear them in Washington, D.C., it is an absolute treat. They, especially on this particular weekend, they'll be performing. But every Friday night here in Washington, there is the Marine Corps Evening Parade. Which takes place at the same barracks, the same area. It's 8th Street and I, where John Philip Sousa lived and worked and wrote. It's just an amazing thing. And you see the band and the color guard, and they time it such, it's a commandant's review, they time it such that the sun goes down before as taps is played and the flag is drawn. It's just amazing. And if you've never been to that in Washington, that's something to add to your list. And they certainly do perform John Philip Sousa marches. It is really a thrill. Well, of course, that really captures the spirit of what it means to be the American warrior. There's no other warrior in the world like that. I mean, they murder and kill efficiently, but the American warrior is taught to do so with honor. And maybe, you know, they probably inherited that from their British roots. I don't know how the British were able to, you know, somehow they fell away from that during the Revolutionary War. But America's goal and standards for their soldiers are very high. And a lot of that is circles around a nobler way of doing things. It goes back to the time of Washington. It was chaplain for his troops. It was love of country and honor. And you don't just take life for the joy of it. And that's, I think, what our soldiers in Iraq, Afghanistan, these men that we see going out and women serving their country with such great distinction and honor, it really is a thing to behold. Thank God for our soldiers. I know that many of you listening are in various forts around the country, and we can't tell you how much and how grateful we are for your service. World War II, of course, our numbers are dwindling of the veterans of World War II. Many of us had dads that fought in World War II. Many of you had grandfathers, and I just urge you, if they're still living, to get their stories, record them, thank them. You know, if you've ever been to these honor flights, if your father or your relative has never been to one, they are still happening. The honor flights are fabulous. That's where they take World War II veterans from all over the country, bring them to D.C., take them to the World War II Memorial, give them this fabulous tribute at both airports. They have music of the 40s playing live. It is really something. I've seen these old men in wheelchairs and some able still to walk just weep as they go through this barrage of people cheering and waving flags. It's a beautiful thing. So if you've never done the honor flight for your father or your grandfather, it's something to look for. Well, just to give the statistics again, we know that most World War II veterans are mostly in their 90s, and they are dying at a rate of about 492 a day. The World War II Museum by here in D.C., by the way, is working to expand their exhibits and their oral histories all the time, and that's also a great place to come to remember 16 million men served in World War II. And there are less than 855,000 of them alive today. So there was a filmmaker, his name is Stephen Klaus, who does videos, beautiful videos. He's done a lot of them, and he has produced a video to talk about how we should feel about these dying men. It's called Just a Common Soldier. It's based on a poem by Lawrence Vancourt, and it is narrated by an actor, Tony LoBianco. I wanted to share it with you today because I think it really, if anything, expresses how so many of us feel about these older men and women, mostly men now for sure, who served their country during one of the fiercest wars on record, World War II. Let's listen to this tribute by Tony LoBianco.
He was getting old and paunchy, and his hair was falling fast. And he sat around the Legion telling stories of the past, of a war that he had fought in, and the deeds that he had done, in his exploits with his buddies. They were heroes, everyone. And though sometimes to his neighbors his tales became a joke, all his Legion buddies listened, for they knew whereof he spoke. But we'll hear his tales no longer, for old Bill has passed away. The world's a little poorer, for a soldier died today. He will not be mourned by many, just his children and his wife. For he lived an ordinary and quite uneventful life. He held a job and raised a family, quietly going his own way. And the world won't note his passing, though a soldier died today. When politicians leave this earth, their bodies lie in state, while thousands note their passing and proclaim that they were great. Papers tell their whole life stories from the time that they were young. But the passing of a soldier goes unnoticed and unsung. Is the greatest contribution to the welfare of our land a guy who breaks his promise and cons his fellow man? Or the ordinary fellow who in times of war and strife goes off to serve his country and offers up his life? A politician's stipend and the style in which he lives are sometimes disproportionate to the service that he gives, while the ordinary soldier who has offered up his all is paid off with a medal, perhaps a pension, small. It's so easy to forget them, for it was so long ago that the old Bills of our country went to battle. But we know it was not the politicians with their compromises and ploys who won for us the freedom that our country now enjoys. Should you find yourself in danger with your enemies at hand, would you want a politician with his ever-shifting stand? Or would you prefer a soldier who has sworn to defend his home, his kin, and country, and would fight until the end? He was just a common soldier, and his ranks are growing thin. But his presence should remind us we may need his like again. For when countries are in conflict, then we find the soldier's part is to clean up all the troubles that the politicians start. If we cannot do him honor while he's here to hear the praise, then at least let's give him homage at the ending of his days. Perhaps just a simple headline in a paper that would say, "Our country is in mourning for a soldier died today.
Sandy Rios in the Morning with You. That can be found at Just a Common Soldier, produced by Stephen Klaus and narrated by Tony LoBianco. And so on behalf of my father, my father-in-law, my other father-in-law, Vietnam veteran, Master Sergeant Sir Faithfully, my husband who served in a different way with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, for all of you men and women out there who have placed your lives on the line in service of your country, we thank you from the bottom of our hearts. We thank you. And we just ask again that your service, remember, we serve as unto the Lord, which is a different standard. And it doesn't matter what the politicians say, what the news headlines say, it says we play to one person, and that is the God of the universe, who knows what we did. He knows. And so we thank you, and I hope that you enjoy your families while at the same time bringing meaning to this day. This is Sandy Rios in the Morning on AFR Talk.